This is Community Transformed with Father Thomas Dubé.
Greetings and welcome to Community Transformed. I'm Father Thomas Dubé. This week we're going to start the second sub-area of our retreat. Started in the sense, after our general observations, I want to get now into the gospel program. What do we do about what is amiss in community? And I'm going to begin with a couple general principles, and they get a little more specific, and then we'll get to some detail. What do we do about what's amiss? Now, the first general kind of principle is to realize that our communities, no matter how good we are individually, are real, and there are going to be defects. That's just the human situation, so we're not surprised when there is something amiss in a marriage or in a convent or in a monastery. There are problems, and that's part of being real. St. Paul speaks of sins even in communities that he knew were very close chronologically to the Lord, and also in living the message. And he speaks of what was amiss at times. Sometimes serious things were wrong. So that's our first point, to realize realistically that there are defects. That doesn't mean we fold our hands and let them all go on, no. But there's some we can't even correct. But anyway, that's our first observation. Now the second one in the program is to be real in another sense. Namely, to be aware of the fact not only there are defects, but there are great beauties almost always in the persons in which we're living with. And that's part of being real also. If you've done much counseling, any of you, you will soon find out that there are many people in our world who can be annoying to others and problems at home or in some other community or in the parish, and yet they are really working hard on what's wrong with them. And you find that out when you get into their heart, that is their mind, when they want to reveal that to you. You can find out there are people that can be very annoying to others, and yet, I'm not saying they're not responsible at all, but they're working at it. And we want to realize that. I'm not saying everybody's working on it. Would that we were. But that's part of being real as well. If I don't see beauty in the people I'm living with, it could well be that it is there, but I'm so annoyed with what disturbs me in them that I'm just kind of closed to seeing the beauty. And so it might be also my fault if I don't find that to be the case, that there is genuine beauty here. Just notice, for example, in St. Paul's letter to the Romans in chapter 1, after a long introduction of 6 verses, he comes to name the recipients of the letter, and he calls them God's beloved in Rome. And he knew very well that the Romans are God's beloved, and he knew too that they had faults. And yet he calls them God's beloved. And so you too should, and I also, when I say you, I mean me as well, you and I should see the persons with whom we're living as also God's beloved, even though that we're annoyed with them on this occasion or that. Now, the third principle, and you'll notice immediately now we're getting more specific. We'll get even more specific further down. The third kind of principle I want to share with you is that according to the gospel, we heal whatever is wrong by something good. We don't retaliate. We don't give it back to somebody else. That's our human inclination. If you're rude to me, I'm going to give you some rudeness back, and you will learn. Nope, we don't do it that way. If you're cold toward me, I'm not going to give you coldness back. If you snap at me, I'm not going to snap back. The principle is we heal what's wrong with something good. Now, let's listen to St. Paul. In his letter to the Romans, chapter 12, the chapter that deals with community at length, 3 times toward the end of the chapter, he makes the point I'm making right here. No less than 3 times. And he does it, of course, beautifully. Let me share them with you. And this chapter, as I said, is almost entirely about community. Conversion is at the beginning of it, verse 2, and then all the rest is how do we live with one another. Verse 14, bless those who persecute you. Never curse them. Bless them. Even if in your life it gets to the point where you're being persecuted, I hope it doesn't get to that point, but even if it does, you bless those who persecute you. Now, this is the Lord on the cross. See, nobody else, as far as I know, no worldview I've ever come across comes close to this for how do you love another person. Even an enemy, even somebody persecuting you. And you will find this is the way the martyrs die. They die loving and forgiving people who are torturing them to death. It's a miracle, a moral miracle, of course. And that's the advice Paul gives to you and me. So if in my life or if in your life somebody is not only unkind to me or to you, even if it comes to the point of persecution, I've never been persecuted, happily, but have a few rough times here or there once in a while, but most of the time I'm treated very well, so I have no complaints whatsoever. But in any event, even if it got so bad as persecution, bless them. We do something good. Verse 17, never repay evil with evil, but let everyone see you are interested only in the highest ideals. So that's, again, notice it's universal. We never repay evil with evil. We're going to do something good. And then in verse 21, resist evil and conquer it with good. So notice we don't let evil get away. At some little things we do, I'll say that later. But we're going to correct and get rid of what's wrong in the community. What's wrong with the marriage should be corrected. Not just go on until both partners are dead. You see, it's supposed to be corrected fairly soon. We'll talk about that later. But we resist evil, we do something about it, but we conquer it with good. Now, I want to spend some time on this because while what I've said and what St. Paul says could not be more clear, I want to use a good number of examples and ways of saying this because it's hard to believe it when you have a disagreement with your spouse, for example, if you're married, or with somebody else in the parish. Proverbs 15:1, a mild answer calms wrath, but a harsh word stirs up anger. That's an application of what we've been saying. So wrath here is understood to be pretty clearly excessive anger, excessive showing of it. What do you do about it? You don't give it back. You do something good, a mild answer. Let me tell you of a concrete experience I had that illustrated that beautifully. Some few years ago, I was asked, I won't even identify the group, of course, I was asked to come in as what they called a resource person, of a discussion of policies in the group. And I was asked just to be there and probably make observations here or there. In any event, it was a group of, I would say, 7 or 8. And it was an academic group with doctorates and master degrees. So I was asked to sit in and help out if I could. And in the course of that discussion, one of the members, I knew 2 or 3 of them very well. And there's one in particular whom I admired highly, an excellent woman. Just really excellent. And in the course of this discussion, I wasn't saying anything really, I was just listening. One of the members of the group really lit in to this one I admired so much, anger, and really blasted at her. And the response that she gave, I forget the exact words, was a mild answer. She didn't give the anger back. She didn't give any abuse back. She just, a mild answer. And that ended the whole scene. It was a scene. It was embarrassing, not only to the other members in the group, it was embarrassing to me, obviously. But she returned evil. She returned for evil. She returned good. That's an example of the gospel principle. And it works exactly as the book of Proverbs says. A mild answer calms wrath. We get rid of something evil by doing something good. Now, the second way I want to make this same point is a little news article, and it dealt with a study by psychologists at Vanderbilt University in Nashville, Tennessee, and the National Institute of Mental Health near Washington, D.C. And the study dealt with men, college students, who were diagnosed as experiencing anxiety or depression. I'm just picking out the main ideas in this little news account. And so what they wanted to find out is, what's the difference in the good done to people who are anxious and depressed, not non-suicidal though, nobody was suicidal here. They had half of the group of students who went just to college professors. No special training in psychotherapy or psychology or psychiatry, no training, but just the math teachers, for example, or English teachers or chemists. Half of them went to that group just to have chats with them. And the other half went to psychotherapists to have chats. And the psychotherapists had average experience of 23 years at their work, therefore experienced people. And these young men were seen twice a week for 3 to 4 months by the two groups. Now here's the result of what happened. I quote the sentence. The team doing this study found that a group of patients treated by college professors, notice, no psychological experience or training, the team found that a group of patients treated by college professors showed the same amount of improvement as a similar group treated by experienced psychotherapists. Surprise, I suppose, to most people. By the way, it doesn't follow that therefore psychotherapists don't do any good. I don't accept that kind of conclusion, because there are some people so wounded, mentally wounded, suffering, they need professional help. And just chatting with other people, even however sympathetic these others are, it's not enough. So that would not be the conclusion. The conclusion we may draw from this, I think validly, is that notice the goodness, just chatting sympathetically, giving no professional advice, because they don't have knowledge of the profession of psychotherapy, but just listening patiently, doing a good thing, does an immense amount of good to these people suffering from anxiety and depression. We overcome the evil, not that it's necessary, it's not a moral evil we're talking about, but a psychological depression, especially clinical type, that's an evil in the way, it's not normal. We overcome the evil with something good. An example of this principle. Now, the third kind of illustration I want to offer you, I know I'm doing this one pretty thoroughly, but it's something that is so easily forgotten in the nitty-gritty of daily life. Is it easily forgotten. The third example is a very different form of literature. It's the Peanuts comic strip. In the strip I have in front of me, Peanuts, apparently there may have been a sequence for several days where Lucy is really cranky. She's a kind of little salty gal anyhow, but anyhow she's cranky. And in this strip there are four little frames to it. And in the first one it's Charlie Brown giving advice to Snoopy, the dog. And the dog is looking toward Lucy's house. And Charlie Brown says to Snoopy, "Don't go near that house today, Snoopy. Lucy's having a crab in." Okay? In the second strip, the little dog, Snoopy, has totally ignored the advice Charlie Brown gave. He has gone to her house, and he's knocking on the door. And he has that a complacent look on his face. "I know what I'm doing," kind of look. In the third strip, in the third one, Lucy puts her head out the door, and Snoopy gives her a big smack, hearts around it, on the nose. Now, why he kisses her on the nose, I don't know, and I'm not going to worry about that. But he's giving her love, signs of love. In the fourth strip, the last one, Lucy has come out of the house. She's looking at the reader in a kind of perplexed way, but not a cranky way. And Snoopy has turned around and he's walking off the doorstep, a complacent look on his face, and he says, or thinks rather, "That's how you break up a crab in. And that's true. Notice, our little dog, Snoopy, corrected something evil, not with something evil, not to go give her a lecture about being crabby, it doesn't do any good, Lucy and all the rest. Doesn't do that at all. He corrects what's wrong with something good. He shows love for Lucy. Same principle, scriptural principle. Another example of it. The fourth example is very brief. All of them are brief, except the last one I want to mention. The fourth example of we correct things wrong with something good, that's the gospel, is the custom, I think fairly common now in hospitals and nursing homes, of having pets around, and for mentally ill people. And it's amazing how much good just a little puppy will do, putting in the arms or around somebody with a mental problem or somebody depressed. It just does a lot of good. So it's the same principle again. Something that's wrong, unfortunate, illness, not that there's necessarily any sin with it, but something's amiss, we correct it with something good. The fifth way I want to make the point is a remark of St. John of the Cross. Somebody had written to him that there's no love in that particular house in which he or she was living. And the advice John gave, one sentence: if there is no love in your house, put love in and you will draw love out. In other words, don't retaliate. Don't be cold. Don't be snappy. Don't be obnoxious. Put something good in that place, namely genuine love, and you will draw love out. Now, I know there's an obvious objection to this, and I'm thinking of it myself. There are some people, you will say, probably, there are some people whom you can show lots of love to and they never change. I think that is true. But they're very mentally ill, these people. Whatever it is, I'm not going to try to analyze. But I'm talking, and John here is talking about at least fairly ordinary people. And if there's no love in your place, you start putting love in, real love, forgiving love, and all the things we've been talking about under shared vision and under this right now in our next section too, of the whole series, you start doing that, and if the person you're living with is at least fairly normal mentally, as John says, you will draw love out. Now, the last example I want to give of this principle, and even if we said nothing else in this program, if we got this one down, Pat, we'd really be getting someplace in living our vocation. The last example is a true story. It deals with sisters. I was giving an experimental teaching program to a group of sisters, young sisters, of different congregations. And there were about 25 in the program. And some of them I knew very well indeed. Some had come to me for spiritual direction, so I knew their inner life and such like. And we had our own program, experimental. It was a different way of going about educating people and in religious life. Well, we needn't go into that. We don't have time for it. But two of the people present in the program were also going to a local secular college for some course. And one day, let's call them sisters A and B. Sister A is the one I'm talking about mostly. Sister B is the companion of Sister A, and they went to school together. I think they probably took different courses. Any event, one day Sister B, the companion, came to me and said, or we met on the campus of this formation college where we were doing our program. We met on the campus and she said, you know, today we were at, and I won't name the place, this secular college, and a girl came up to Sister A. She didn't call her A, of course. She gave me her ordinary name. We're calling her A. This girl came up full of hatred. And she walked up to Sister A and she said this: I hate Catholics and I hate nuns. That's all she told me about the meeting. And then she added, and I'm giving you only her words. I know them verbatim because I can't forget them, you see. She then said, you know, in 10 minutes, that girl, full of hatred, that girl was asking Sister A, can I take you home in my car? That's almost incredible. That hatred, so rudely expressed, I hate Catholics and I hate nuns, the nerve of that girl to say that to anybody. Now, it so happens that Sister A had a beautiful smile. I just knew that, and everybody on the campus knew that, you see. So that when she would greet you, you just this radiant smile. But I'm pretty sure there's something else behind it. We won't go into that, because that's sort of confidential sort of thing. But it wasn't just a natural smile. There's something divine. I'll say that much about it. Divine, I mean it's God-inspired sort of thing. So, I wish that Sister B had told me how this came about, that in 10 minutes you got this transformation. But she didn't tell me. I will tell you what I think was behind it. I know Sister A well enough that she wouldn't, when she was addressed with this rude, I hate Catholics and I hate nuns, she did not trot out a syllogism to explain that hatred is self-destructive and give her all kinds of reasoning. You could certainly set up a large part of rational thinking that shows that girl she's out of bounds. But I'm pretty sure Sister A didn't try that at all. What Sister A did, I'm almost as sure as I'm standing here, is give that girl a radiant smile. And I don't know what else she said. I just don't know it, so I'm not going to make it up. And it melted that girl. That's for sure. Notice Sister A overcame something about as evil as you can get. After hating God himself, how bad can you get than to hate another person and be so crude about it? She corrected what was wrong with something good. And that's the gospel way of doing things. Okay. So, we are now ready for our program. We've talked about what we do not do about something wrong. Tell it to somebody else. Go report to the superior is the first step. That's ordinarily not what you do, you see. We take up in our program, what do we do? We started with the general principles. We got a little more specific. We conquer what's wrong in the community, in the marriage, in the convent, whatever the place is. We conquer it with good. Now, we're going to be a little more specific. The first step in correcting what's wrong is forgiveness. Genuine forgiveness. And I'm going to have to say quite a bit about this because forgiveness is not easily understood by a lot of people. There are a fair number of misunderstandings about it. And I want to touch on them so we see really what we mean. Forgiveness is possible. There are people who think they cannot forgive because they identify it with feelings. I still feel resentful. I am still angry at what she did or he did to me. And I can't forgive. They're misunderstanding what forgiveness is. I'll explain that a little further down. The first thing to notice, forgiveness is not only essential, but it's got to be there. And the first point I wish to make about that is that there's a built-in hazard in this discussion of gospel community from the beginning to now. One of the built-in hazards is people who listen to this series and say, I must change, can easily come to the point after they try to live these things and the other person isn't changing much, they figure that it's been all for in vain. They haven't changed. Or my husband hasn't changed. Or my wife doesn't change. The hazard is that the person will think that good as the ideas were in that series, I tried them out and they don't work. The point I want to make right now is that the hazard, the built-in hazard, is giving up. And I want to say right here, no matter what has gone on in your marriage or in your monastery, or no matter what may go on, whatever faults may lie in the future, I want to say, let him or her who is without sin cast the first stone. That's the Lord's remark, as you know, to the people who are going to stone the woman taken in adultery. And so we've got to begin with forgiveness. And we will begin next week with this very item in our steps to take in correcting, healing what is amiss. Thank you, and God bless.
You have been listening to Community Transformed with Father Thomas Dubé on EWTN Global Catholic Radio.